Tomorrow, it's 100 years to the day since Douglas Mawson, a 29-year-old geologist, sailed from Hobart in the Aurora to lead the Australasian Antarctic Expedition, a quest to explore the unknown southern continent. A lot of activities are planned to mark this commemoration, including three Antarctic cruise ships heading out for Commonwealth Bay and Mawson's Hut. There's also a host of functions, exhibitions, a centenary dinner with the Minister, the Governor-General and 650 other people tonight. The Governor-General will also launch a new take on the Douglas Mawson story by biographer Peter Fitzsimons. I spoke with Peter earlier about the story of Mawson and his exploits on the ice.
I found it absolutely absorbing, and the more so when I actually went to Antarctica, to Mawson's Hut in January of this year. And when you actually go down there, the first thing about Antarctica is it is stunning. For me, it was the first time I really had an idea of what the planet might have looked like 50,000 years ago before mankind put up shopping malls. You get there and then you see in this tiny little cleft in the cliffs, basically, in the slopes, Mawson's huts, and think, well, I can just about believe that men in 1911 would have had the wherewithal to build a hut there. But to voluntarily head off, trek 300 miles, where every step that they take is a step never taken by mankind before. And that was the thing that stunned me. It was Captain Cook who was the first one who got within cooee of Antarctica. It couldn't get through. It was 1895 before the first documented time anybody actually set foot on that continent, and that ushered in the heroic age, the next two decades after 1895. The four titans of that age were Scott of the Antarctic, of course, Sir Ernest Shackleton, Sir Douglas Mawson, and Roald Amundsen from Norway. I couldn't help but notice that as our man Mawson was trekking along the coast, you had at exactly the same time this staggering race between Scott of the Antarctic and Amundsen to get to the South Pole. So the way I tried to frame the book was to tell more or less parallel stories, looking at Mawson, but also looking at Amundsen, Scott and Shackleton. And I suppose the part that most absorbed me was the death of Scott and his men. And I just found the pathos of that, the romance of the story, the epic nature of it, I was transfixed by it.
I agree that that's a terribly powerful story, but story after story is epic, as you describe it. And if you think about Mawson and some of these others, Shackleton similarly, they are so complete in a sense. Mawson was a scientist, he was a thinker, but physically strong enough to endure the worst of Antarctica.
I think the modern terminology, if you put it in sporting terms, which I sometimes want to do, Fran, he was the complete package. He was this absolutely devoted scientist, absolutely top-notch. He was raised in Glebe, went to Sydney University at the age of 16, first degree by 19, second degree by 22. He was absolutely top-notch as a scientist, physically very, very strong, built like a rugby back rower and capable of taking a lot of pain. He was also a leader of men. He was able to organise his men in such a fashion that they were able to produce tremendous results. He was first and foremost, in my view, a scientist. So he had absolutely no interest in the South Pole itself. That was for the glory boys. Good luck to Amundsen and good luck to Scott. But there was no scientific interest there. He was very interested in the South Magnetic Pole, and he was one of the party of three that got there for the first time. He was one of the first party to scale Mount Erebus. And it was while on Mount Erebus, as a part of the Shackleton Nimrod exhibition 1907 to 1909, that he gazed to the west and conceived the notion that there were 2,000 miles of Antarctic coastline directly south of Australia that no one had ever set foot on. And his point to the Australian government upon his return was, I should do this. You should give me the money. I should mount an expedition. It'll be a scientific expedition. We'll claim the territory for Australia. We'll have three bases there. We'll chart the glaciers, the mountains. We'll do great scientific inquiry, and it will be a great thing for Australia and, in his conception, for the British Empire.
Was that a hard sell? Was it hard to convince
It was a very hard sell because, you know, the time were tough. The money wasn't necessarily available. He had to go to England to try to raise money there. He tried to convince Scott to merge their expeditions, but in fact Scott had no desire to do that, and there was quite some friction between them on that account, and Mawson was also very close to Shackleton. So all these titans were aligned with each other, with the exception of Amundsen. It was when Scott got to Melbourne, so he was on his way to Antarctica, and he got the telegram from Roald Amundsen, broadly stating, "Dear Captain Scott, just so as you know, I'm on my way there to see you at the South Pole." That's not exactly what it said, but it was a great shock to Scott that he found himself in a race because he thought he was there on his own. And, yeah, it was an epic saga across the board.
You're listening to ABC Radio National Breakfast. Our guest this morning is Peter Fitzsimons and his new book, Mawson and the Icemen of the Heroic Age. This was obviously dangerous. Mawson had been there before with Shackleton. He knew the danger. His team knew the danger. These people go there despite that. But it was not without tragedy. Companions perished, and indeed, he nearly got lost himself.
Yes, and that's the climax of the Mawson story. So Scott dies on the March 29, 1912, and he's the last of his group to die. So you got March 16, you have the famous Captain Lawrence Oates stands up in a blizzard saying, I'm going outside and should be some time, never to be seen again. His three companions last another fortnight or so. They die. They find the body of Scott and his men on the 12th of November 1912, and it is at that point that Mawson, from his own camp, is heading out with two men, with an Englishman, Belgrave Ninnis, and a Swiss man by the name of Xavier Mertz, and they begin to trek along the coast, and they discover glaciers, and they're charting, taking their readings, and they're going well until December 12, the first tragedy strikes, when they are crossing a white plain, and suddenly Mawson looks up to see Xavier Mertz, the Swiss man who's 100 yards out in front, suddenly lift his right pole, warning, crevasse. Mawson stops, looks at Mertz, and Mertz has got this horrified expression on his face, and he realises that Mertz is looking behind him. So Mawson turns round to see what's wrong with Ninnis. Where's Ninnis? Ninnis had fallen into a crevasse. It's not simply an open crevasse. They're crevasses with snow bridges over them. So they're not discernible in the white plain. And if they're weak, you fall in. They look down into the jaws of hell. The crevasse that Ninnis has fallen into with 80% of their food is so deep, they cannot see the bottom. All they can see is one dog with a broken back about 150 yards down. They yell down the crevasse for 3 hours, totally hopelessly. They know he's dead and they know they've lost their food. Mawson does a brief funeral service. Things are desperate. They immediately turn back. There's a few rations left, but they have to live off eating the dogs. And Mertz, the Swiss man, who's a very cheery soul and a very strong soul, gets weaker and weaker and weaker with the dogs. His hair starts to fall out. His skin starts to shed, and by the 7th of January, he cannot go on. And it's desperate for Mawson, because without two of them hauling, he can't nurse a sick man. In Antarctica, to tarry is to die. Mm. And mercifully, Mertz dies, and there is Mawson all alone. And so begins the saga. Mawson, I think at that point, 120 miles from safety with very, very little food, begins the trek. He cuts the sledge in half, and then there is the saga of him falling down a crevasse on the 17th of January, finding himself dangling from the harness. Mercifully, again, the sledge at the top has got jammed in the top of the crevasse, and he's hanging suspended. And by his fabulous account in Home of the Blizzard, he feels to himself that it would be so easy at this point just to slip out of this harness, to float away to oblivion and not have to suffer any of this pain anymore. But what propels him to struggle to the surface was the love of his fiancée waiting for him in Adelaide. And he doesn't feel he can live, but he feels that he can at least get close enough, that he can leave Paquita a letter that they'll find, that he can leave his scientific records. And he gets near to the surface after 2 hours of struggle, and it collapses again, and again he's suspended. And by his later account at a dinner he spoke at in New York, he said it took him 4 hours the second time to get to the surface. And so it goes. He keeps going. The soles of his feet are coming away. He gets terrible, terrible aches all over his body, and all he can do is keep struggling on until finally, on the 8th of February, and this is perhaps the most famous scene in the Mawson saga, against all odds, he comes over the lip of the hill, looking down upon the base, Mawson's hut, and what does he see? There on the horizon is his ship. And it's not that his ship is coming in, his ship is going out. He missed it by 5 hours. So the ship is heading out over the horizon, which means he must stay there for another year. Now, again, the captain of that ship, Captain John King Davis, had left five men behind on the 1 in 100 chance that Mawson and his men would struggle in. And so Mawson finds himself being nursed back to health.
Certainly a lot to it, and the torturous tales, as you say. Getting inside Mawson's head, as you have to do to understand what makes Douglas Mawson and these other guys tick, what do you think Mawson and the others would think of today's modern explorers with all their equipment, all their polar tech, all their satellite navigation? Do you think they were soft?
Perhaps, but I think they'd also be jealous because they did it seriously tough back then. And they were very tough, very strong men, but they would be completely stunned to see the comfort with which the explorers can do it now. But on the other hand, I'll say this, those explorers that are doing it now, I take my hat off to them too, because to scale those mountains that they do is still a very hard exercise. And as I say, when I went down to Antarctica in January, I was in awe of those who have the courage to leave the confines of the coastal part of Antarctica, where their life abounds, the penguins and the whales and the seals, and actually head out into that polar wilderness. And, I dips my lid to them.
Mm. Unimaginable even today. Peter Fitzsimons, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Fran Kelly.
Of course, today we have Polar Tech. That's Peter Fitzsimons and Mawson and the Icemen of the Heroic Age. Scott, Shackleton and Amundsen is published by Random House. And Hobart, no doubt, a buzz over the next few days with centenary celebrations marking Douglas Mawson's Australasian Antarctic expedition 100 years ago tomorrow.